Nick Jans writes essays about life in Arctic Alaska from his vantage point in Ambler, a village at the edge of the Brooks Range in northwestern Alaska. A Place Beyond is his second book, and in the preface, he writes that his essays try to find words that are, quote, not big enough, but small enough for a landscape and a place without end. I asked him to read from a section called The Killing Fields, where he describes a time caribou hunting with his friend Clarence.
As the caribou are led by the web of memory, so it seems are we. Behind us, overgrown by willow and alder, are circular depressions, ancient house pits, marking where people once sat watching, as we do now. Old-timer's place, Clarence calls it. Across the field, antlered skulls lie scattered, marking kills, years or decades old. Sunk into the tundra are older bones and the stone tools, those who left them. Past these, the caribou trot, white manes shimmering. We'll just take one good one, breathes Clarence. And I can tell he wants me to shoot. Which, I whisper, the second, with the thick horns, or the first one? Clarence appraises, maybe that one, says, pointing to the lead bull, a big-bodied animal with rack still in velvet. 70 yards away, they smell us. The bulls halt stiff-legged, staring. I chamber around, rise and fire. I know I've missed high. They mill around. I work at another shell, hold lower, and this time there's the whump of a hit. The lead bull stands for a second, head down, then his legs buckle. The others trot off, no more hurried than before. 5 minutes later, we hear them splashing across the river. Clarence wields his pocket knife, making a quick, speculative cut down the brisket. That, he murmurs with pleasure, drawing out the words, as he always does. Trophy antlers are of no concern, and hides in these days of down jackets and nylon, less important. But meat, good fat meat, is still a measure of wealth.
In this essay, you describe the land and the animals and the people, all interacting together. And I'm curious, Nick, do you regard any of these elements as being separate from any of the others?
It's pretty hard to separate anything up here. It all kind of washes together. The landscape made the people the way they are. The animals they hunted made the people the way they are. And in turn, the people affected both things and continue to do so. It's pretty seamless, really.
It seems like a lot of people would maybe mourn that the people in Ambler are trading older traditions of the land for newer ones from outside. But I don't get, though, that you judge any of this, that you're just kind of documenting it. And I'm wondering if it's easier for you in some ways to sit on the fence.
Oh, well, I live here. I almost have to. And I do mourn it. I think anybody who pays any attention really would do the same. But at the same time, things go on, you know. There are a lot of things that you can't really mourn. That's actually one of the allusions that my first title, my first book, The Last Light Breaking, was making. It's basically telling you that you can't mourn things that are past and that you shouldn't mourn death. Because death and life are the same. And that's a very simplistic way of putting it, and it does it much more beautifully. But that's the idea. And Eskimo culture isn't dead. It's just something else. This is Eskimo culture now.
How do you view your mission now as a writer? Is it as someone writing a documentary?
Well, that's certainly part of it. And I do think that I have... I don't know, it sounds kind of highfalutin, but a duty to witness and to try and be true to what I see and not extrapolate, not try and make things up. I guess that's partly why I have written the first two books and even more so the second the way I do, in a very flat way that seems like it's fence-sitting. But at the same time, what it is I'm trying to let the reader participate. I'm just presenting the facts in an extremely neutral way. I mean, there's little emotional things I can do, of course, through my writing. But basically, I'm letting them arrive at their own conclusions.
How does that go over, being essentially an outsider observing the culture and writing about it and living at it at the same time?
Well, local people, and as a matter of fact, Alaska Natives, seem very appreciative of the book. They believe it explains themselves to themselves. And that's the highest compliment I could have. It beats a review in the New York Times in a very real sense to me, because I presume a lot by writing about other cultures, and yet I've had calls as far away as from St. Paul Island down in the Pribilofs, and Indians from the interior all calling and saying, right on, this book explains exactly the way it is, not just for Inupiaq Eskimos, but for many native bush Alaskans. That was something I didn't really quite expect. I wasn't sure how that would end up.
Read a bit of that last essay there called The Place.
I could tell you where I was with map and compass, an orderly list of facts. Put it this way, it's all clear enough. I traveled with snow machine up the east fork of the Ipnelevik on an April morning and made it almost as far as Blind Pass, where I ran into overflow and turned back. The mountains were jagged and white, the sky deep blue. I saw where a gerfalcon had hit a ptarmigan and left bones, feathers, and wing prints scattered on the crest of a knoll. I followed fresh wolverine tracks and traced the week-old meandering of a young grizzly to a side canyon so narrow the rocks almost touched overhead. Turning up the Ipnelevik's west branch, I rode through unmarked powder to the base of an arete where I ate lunch, played harmonica, and listened to the snowmelt. Over the course of the day, I shot several rolls of film, picked up a sunburn, and got my machine stuck a few times in the long shadows of evening, heading home. I cut a fresh grizzly trail, followed it, and caught a glimpse of its maker. All this tells where I've been, but explains nothing. It doesn't tell you that kneeling over the falcon's kill, I wept, that as I rode, I laughed aloud and often stopped to raise my arms to the sky, not knowing what else to do, that I took 50 photos at the same peak in shifting light, that when I played my harmonica, it was for the mountains, as if they could hear. It's been 4 years now. I look back, vaguely embarrassed, as I would have been if someone had seen me that day. I can't tell you that my heart left my body and came back filled with light, or that I forgot for a time where the land ended and I began. Even if it's true, words like map and compass tell one story, but fail at another. Just as when I sorted through the 50 slides I took of that mountain and ended up throwing most out. The ones I kept were fine. Sharp focus, good composition, proper exposure. But the thing I tried to hold had slipped away. I've been to the Ipnelevik since, and it's still good country, some of the best I've seen. The mountains remain bathed in light, and bears roam through silent canyons where the rocks almost meet overhead. But the place I seek is somewhere else now, just over the next ridge, or the one beyond. I ride out, hoping.
Are you still hoping?
You bet. You know, that's one thing, is that I think, although this book talks about the passing of things, and there's a sense of sitting in this suspended little timeless place with the world closing in around it, that there is everything that humanity can hope for here. Because basically, you live in the middle of a landscape that defines you as you define it, and yet our footprints, at least here, have been gentle enough on the land that you can see the way it was and sense a connection to where it came from and where we all came from. And I think it's that sense of being connected, procession, going somewhere, is finally where the hope comes from.
Kind of a long caribou march.
You bet. It never stops. It's always moving. And in that movement alone, there's some kind of hope.
right, well, thanks very much, Nick.
You bet.
The first thing I'm going to ask is for you to give a correct pronunciation of your name.
We call ourselves the Boys of the Loch, and that's it's the name of a tune, actually, that was recorded in the early years of the century by a very famous Irish fiddle player called Michael Coleman, who emigrated to New York, and he made his living playing music in the Bronx, and he made recordings, many of which went back to Ireland and became very influential on the fiddle music back there.
Okay, now why don't you introduce yourself and tell us what you play?
Well, my name is Dave Richardson. I'm not actually Irish or Scottish. I'm from the north of England. We have our own traditional music there, which is like a dialect of the music in Scotland and Ireland. We have our own particular kind of bagpipe, Northumbrian small pipes, and lots of music came in with people who migrated into the area to work. Just the same as you'd find in this country, you know, in any big city.
Right, sure. So what instruments do you play then?
Mandolin, cittern, which is like a bass mandolin, a little button instrument called an English concertina, and also another button instrument called the button accordion, two-row button accordion.
Okay. All right, we'll go around the table and introduce the other members of the band who are with us. There are five here in Fairbanks for the show, but three have visited us at the studio.
Yeah, two of them are still hibernating. my name's Chris Newman. I'm from England. I'm the newest member of the band. I've been playing with the band for a couple of years now. And I play guitar. And it's my first visit up here to this part of the country. And it's just wonderful to be here. It's really tremendous.
Are you dressed properly?
Absolutely. I spent all last week going out buying thermal stuff, which I put on about an hour and a half ago, and I'm as warm as toast.
Now you're fine.
That's pretty good.
That's good. Okay, we'll continue around the table.
My name is Christy O'Leary, and I come from the southwest of Ireland, from a place called Kinmare in County Kerry. And I play the Illan pipes, or the Irish pipes, or the elbow pipes. They've got a lot of different names. And they're kind of complicated bagpipe instrument, which has, the instrument has got seven reeds.
Oh my gosh.
And a bellows, and the melody part of the instrument is called a chanter, and it's got drones, and so it's a fairly kind of strange looking instrument if you haven't seen one before, but in Ireland it's the national instrument.
Okay, right, and you're right, I haven't seen one before, and we could probably talk at length about each of the instruments you're playing. I mean, they're different to us, but maybe you could, the three of you, talk about your experience, how you began playing and where you learned.
Well, I started playing the pipes when I was about 16, having played the tin whistle, which was the normal course of progression from one of those instruments to the other. Normally people start off with the tin whistle, or the penny whistle as it's called over here, and move on to either the old simple system concert flute, which is the instrument most used by wind players in Irish music, rather than the Bohm system steel flute that you see in orchestras nowadays. And people usually choose a concert flute, or they go on to the Illan pipes. And I chose the Illan pipes because I was always fascinated by the sound of them, and the reedy sound and everything. So I started playing when I was about when I was about 16, which is a long time ago.
Now, is that in a school setting, or?
No. The school setting is a lot healthier nowadays. In the last 10 years or so, in Ireland especially. And when I was going to school, there was no opportunity to learn traditional music in the school system. The only way you could learn it was through, if there were old players around, or, you know, just a strong tradition of musicians around who you could learn from and hear from.
Right. Okay. Dave, how about you?
Well, I started off pretty much like Christy in my sort of early teens. I first heard this kind of music locally, and started off like Christy with a tin whistle. Basically, I think nobody ever had any money, which is why you buy these instruments, which are very cheap, and then you learn the rudiments of music on them. And a little bit further down the road, you get your hands on some cash, and then you're able to buy another instrument of a different kind and work with that. But essentially, I was just self-taught. You know, I heard other people play and took it from there. You know, you mess around. It's a little journey of discovery on each instrument, and that that's the fascination. I mean, even if I wasn't in the Boys of the Lock, I'd still be doing that at home, you know.
Right, right. And Chris, do you...
Well, I've been playing guitar all my life. I mean, I started when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And I was very, very small. I mean, I was really minute.
Uh-huh.
And really, because I have a brother 10 years older than me who got a guitar for his, 14th, 15th birthday or something like that.
Oh.
And I was a precocious 4-year-old and said, you know, I want one as well. And so I did. And I've actually never done anything else. I mean, I've been playing traditional music for about the last 10 years or so.
And where did you pick that up? That
Oh, just from purely from meeting people. I mean, hearing it and just being on the same kind of circuit, you know, playing with different people and becoming involved with it. I mean, prior to that, I'd done a lot of swing jazz stuff and, you know, been in a couple of sort of pop groups and, I mean, real sort of mixture of stuff over the years. I mean, anything really to make a living playing the guitar.
You're the fifth Beatle, right?
I wish.
Well, now you have a new CD out, Midwinter Night's Dream.
That's right.
Talk about that.
The whole idea behind it was we wanted to do a collection of music from the midwinter and also involving Christmas, but we didn't want to do a Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, or, you know, one of these ones about snowmen and things. We wanted to use music from the tradition. Some of it is actually pagan music. It's from outside the Christian tradition, and some of it includes carols and you know, titles like the Christ Child Lullaby, the Night in Bethlehem. Other ones, especially the ones from the Shetland Islands, are associated more with the Nordic sort of midwinter, you know, the solstice, which was more important.
Why did you choose the winter's theme?
It was just an idea, you know. I mean, we have done like 16 previous CDs, which have generally been a mixture of song and music from the different areas represented within the band: Shetland, Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, occasionally Northumberland, where I come from, and we thought it would be nice to do something thematic, you know. And here was a lot of this music that we had, which a lot of it's very little known, and especially the slower tunes, because people just don't play them. I mean, if you walk into a pub in Edinburgh for a session of music, you'll hear mainly reels played, you know, or jigs or the faster tunes. The ritual tunes tend not to have so much exposure because they're not immediately conceived of as entertainment.
You know. Okay. Well, Christy, do any of the songs have any special meaning for you?
Yeah, there's quite a few of them that do, actually. One of them, I sing a song or a part of a song on this called San Staffan Han Rider, which is a Swedish carol, which I learned from my wife, because I live, part of my time is spent in Sweden, where my wife comes from. So she taught me that carol, which is about St. Stephen. And we have a common tradition in Ireland surrounding St. Stephen as well. So that was significant. So I sang that one in Swedish. And there was another one that I, another kind of an obscure carol that I did in Irish, which was given to us from an old friend of one of the other members in the band, Cathal McConnell. It was a man called Paddy Bono Brin, who gave us this song called The Night in Bethlehem, it's called in English, and the Nihu Ud I Mehel, it's called in Irish. And those two pieces I really enjoy doing, because they were very different and also just very, very beautiful tunes.
Thank you very much for stopping by and visiting, taking time out of your schedule. We appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. It's nice to be here again.
Howard Luke Alternative High School was designed to fit students who didn't fit into the district's standardized middle and high schools. It was founded in 1989 when the district combined its alternative junior and senior high schools, but Fairbanks North Star Borough School District Superintendent John Monahan says the school has lost its mission and he's hoping to redefine it.
We don't want to say it's been a dumping ground, but in some respects it's been turned into that, and we're hoping that by looking at the program and refocusing its attention, that we can get the support of the community and the other schools that are feeding into it and the school board, and maybe just, you know, come up with a top-notch refocused program.
The school serves about 150 students, more than a third of which are Alaska Natives. It includes flexible schedules, work study, and other classes not available elsewhere. Monahan recently came to Fairbanks after serving as superintendent of the Iditarod School District in McGrath. He says many of the school students were being poorly served. As part of the changing mission, he's trying to rebuild the school. That means bringing in a 7-member committee that includes the school board, the Fairbanks Native Association, a parent, teachers, and staff. He's also asking the teachers and staff to reapply for their jobs.
I didn't want the administration or any of the staff that are currently at the school to feel like they were locked into that. So I gave, basically everybody will have involuntary transfer status and can reapply for this new philosophy, this new mission that's taking place at the school.
Monahan says this is just one part of a broader district-wide change that will encompass changes at other schools to ensure they all work together.
We'd like to see these things, as far as a long-term vision, feeding into one another, and that for students all the way up the spectrum, we have alternatives available for them. So we're just taking a big overall look at our programs and what options we provide for children.
In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
The Talkeetna Trail Committee's mandate is to get information, look at options, and work as a liaison with the other trail efforts in the borough. The decision to form the group came after a presentation from Ron Aldridge of Dog Drivers North, a group which successfully secured a $13,000 grant to create a trunk trail system from existing trails and mark, map, and publicize them. Aldridge tried to promote the idea by pointing out that in the lower 48, such trail systems have channeled snow machiners away from sensitive areas and people's backyards.
And keep them in that corridor and keep them up. I've had the four-wheelers drive in there, come in, and they do Brody right in the middle of my garden.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I happen to live on the end of a driveway.
Yeah.
And they say, so if we can channel these things, I think we're going to win a battle.
Aldridge's presentation became a mini-showdown when Becky Long and Dennis Ramsey pointed out that they've been trying to get a copy of the proposed grant and trail system for months with little success. Long does not buy the idea that marketing trails will reduce the pressure on the backcountry from recreational snow machiners.
They'll just go anywhere. I mean, people get turned on to an area, and these high-powered snow machines, I mean, they can be across the Alaska Range in a day, go hunting and come back to Anchorage. I mean, those are the kind of technology we're dealing with. And he wants to put brochures out and blah, blah, blah. And I think it's just going to attract more development. And I'm concerned about habitat, and I'm concerned about liability.
Pam Robinson was appointed chairwoman of the new trail committee, which is seeking members from the community. This is Johanna Urich.
It was the second time this year that the Bureau of Land Management failed to receive an offer on over 5 million cubic feet of mostly beetle-kill spruce. The timber is located along the Richardson Highway north of Valdez near the Teakel River. The almost $238,000 price tag attracted no buyers despite a second-time-around waiver of export restrictions requiring in-state primary processing. BLM Forester Mike Zeidlitz says the relatively large offering was suited to big outfits like Ketchikan Pulp or Copper River Forest Products and doomed by market conditions. Copper River Forest Products operations manager Todd Thies says the spruce and the sale are too light and scattered to make access and transport economical.
The market conditions are terrible there at the moment, and that particular sale, the volume's just not that great for what the BLM was asking for it. We would have loved to have bid on it, and we still may. If it comes back across the table, we may, based on if we get an additional market. But at this point in time, the markets just aren't there to make it worthwhile to go out and spend those kind of bucks and sit on it until the markets do come back.
Thies says the current market price for pulp is $22 a ton and that Copper River Forest Products pays loggers $20 a ton to cut, leaving little room for transportation costs and profit. Thies says Copper River hauled thousands of tons of pulp trees this year from Chitna and Otna Native Corporation lands to port at Valdez. He says the beetle-kill spruce there are denser and heavier, and that contracts and roads were developed when pulp prices were higher. Prices have slipped 50% during 1996 from a high of $45 a ton due to burgeoning inventories and increased housing starts and lumber production, of which pulp is a byproduct. The BLM Zeidlitz says the Teakle River salvage sale may be offered up again, possibly in smaller parcels, but that it will be beyond saleability soon, as most of the trees there have been dead 7 or 8 years now. He says reforestation is as much a goal as profit in the offering of the timber, and that the sale is rare for the BLM because so few of its 90 million in-state acres are road accessible. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
She's just up there operating a fish wheel, and but her rights to operate that fish wheel or collect fish how she wants is has been pretty much the seed for a lot of the current standing of the federal versus state subsistence management.
Wilhelmina sat quietly in a kitchen chair and watched from her window as the sun edged up behind the trees, red and molten like the swollen, dying star of an ancient world. She was so tired that her body felt weightless, as if she'd already left it hollow of her spirit. It seemed that she had lived such a long time. Howard had courted her in a horse-drawn wagon. An entire world of souls had disappeared in their time, and other nameless souls had filled their spaces. Someone of them had taken Howard's soul. Bill had rolled onto his side in sleep, his tongue slack on the floor, his poor stomach as round and taut as a honeydew melon. After such a gorging, there normally would be hell to pay, but Wilhelmina would not allow that to happen. "I'll take you to the doctor myself, old Bill," she said. As if in response, a faint and easy dream howl escaped Bill's throat, someone calling another in the big woods across empty fields and deep silent stands of trees. "Ooh," it went, high and soft. "Ooh." Wilhelmina's heart thickened with emotion. Her voice was deep and rich with it. "Hoo," she called softly to Bill's sleeping ears. "Ooh," Bill called again, a little stronger, and she responded, "Hoo." Their pure wordless language, like echoes in the morning air.
Frank Sos reading a selection from one of the stories in Last Days of the Dogmen by Brad Watson. Well, hello to you today, Frank.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, sir. Some beautiful writing in that passage that you read to us. Who is Brad Watson?
I don't know. This is his first book of stories. There are eight nicely made stories in this book, and all feature a dog in one way or another. But beyond that, he's kind of a mystery. Two of these stories were published in Story Magazine and another one in a newspaper, but before the book, he was not well published, and I'm not sure who this guy is. A number of his narrators and characters seem to work for small-town southern newspapers, so my guess is that Brad Watson may have done that for a while himself.
Could we call him a southern writer?
Oh, yeah, he's definitely a southern writer.
Well, how do you mean that?
Well, I think that there are elements of writing that southerners enjoy more than others, and one of them probably is voice. And that story I just read you, which is called Bill, has a pretty nice voice. It's told on behalf of Wilhelmina, an older woman whose husband is dying in an old folks' home, and her pet poodle, Bill, is dying too. But what we get are these stories that are sort of awash with interesting language and funny, often funny turns of phrases, but that doesn't mean the stories are exclusively comic. I think they all have comic turns. And some of them might even be said to be comic at the end, but most are not. Most of them are in that tradition of funny things that have to be funny because otherwise they would make you too sad.
Well, the South has produced a rich succession of authors, but when you say short story writing, one thinks originally of Flannery O'Connor, one of the greatest short story writers of our century. Does Mr. Watson owe anything to her?
He's read his O'Connor and maybe his Eudora Welty too, and it comes through in both cases, not so much in plot, but in his attention to interesting figures of speech and his use of verbs. And for O'Connor especially, there's a certain kind of melancholy knowledge that a Flannery O'Connor narrator knows that sort of gets into the story's atmosphere. You know things aren't so good here, and yet the story's kind of leading you along, and there's just this undertow of melancholy. And I think Watson does a really good job of getting that out.
When you set up a collection of stories, and I'm thinking of Yeats's 11 Kinds of Loneliness here, that suggests that there's going to be a common theme, I think it must place a big burden on the author to come through with what might seem like a device or an artificial, you know, element.
Yeah, I think that you wonder that. You wonder, are all these dogs in these stories because they're truly integral to what's going on, or are there stories where the dog is sort of a walk-on feature? And I think for the most part, the dogs in these stories belong there. There's a story called A Retreat, which is about a couple of guys who go out bird hunting. They really kind of go out bird hunting because they need to talk about one of the characters' infidelities and the failure of his marriage. And they do take a dog along named Mary, who's a retriever. And you got to have a bird dog to hunt birds, but that's about all she does in this story. She's there, but unlike other stories, like the title story, Last Days of the Dog Men, the dogs really aren't, that dog's not out in the middle of the story as an integral part of what goes on.
Sort of a Shaggy Dog story.
Well, actually, there's the shaggiest dog story in here is the last one, which turns out to, there are a couple of dogs running around in this story, and we've gone boar hunting with dogs. And so there's all this dog behavior going around, but it turns out this story is really probably about cannibalism. And the dogs, in some ways, are kind of a shaggy element, maybe shaggy red herrings to what's really going on here. But so the story's a little tricky in that way.
Well, it sounds like Watson has a good sense of humor.
He has a good sense of humor, and he has a good ability to develop odd situations and take them to serious places. There's a story in here where a woman mails herself in a kind of a shipping crate via UPS to her sort of sometimes lover. Maybe they've broken up. They've been broken up for a while, and she wants back in his life, so she mails herself in this shipping crate, and he can't figure it out, and the ups man can't figure it out, and then the crate starts talking, and if she's in there. Well, this is a kind of a dumb and kind of risky premise for a story, but their exchanges through the walls of the crate finally come up to something. It's not all just a clever turn on putting a character in a trunk.
We're talking about The Last Days of the Dogmen, a collection of stories by Brad Watson. Who put it out, Frank?
W.W. Norton. This book is still only out there in hardback. But it's a book that's well worth reading. It's got a lot of charm, and each one of the stories is very good.
And I guess maybe look for future a promising collection, huh?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this guy goes. It's his first book, and they're good stories.
Last Days of the Dogmen, W.W. Norton, the publisher, all written by Brad Watson. Every other week, writer. And Professor Frank Sost joins us for A Worthy Read. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you, Robert.